I call this meeting of the Judiciary Committee to order. Members and staff, this is our first remote hearing that we're live streaming. And before we get started, I'd like to go over a few things before we start official business. First, we're holding this remote hearing pursuant to House Rule 10.01 passed on the floor on March 26, 2020, which allows for remote hearings to take place during this declared peacetime emergency. The rule has a sunset provision of January 31st of 2031. The rule states that during the peacetime emergency declared by the governor on March 13th in Executive Order 2001, or during any other peacetime emergency related to infectious disease, COVID-19 declared by the governor pursuant to Minnesota Statutes 12.31 prior to January 31st, 2021, the Minnesota House of Representatives may allow floor and committee procedures related to member debate and voting to occur by any means of distance voting, remote electronic voting, or voting by other means designed to allow legislative operations while preserving the safety of the public, staff, and members. Use of distance voting, remote electronic voting, or voting by other means under paragraph A may only occur at the direction of the Speaker of the House after consultation with the minority leader and majority leader. It must be used only to protect the health and safety of the public, staff, and members, and must cease once doing so is no longer necessary to protect the health and safety of the public, staff, and members. Finally, committee meetings held by alternate means must provide the public with an opportunity to provide testimony. Now, members, please keep yourself on mute when you are not voting or speaking. You can raise your hand, as I'll go over in a second, but please do not break in with an opinion or quip, as it will substantially interrupt the proceedings far more than it would in a live face-to-face setting. If you are on your computer, you can unmute yourself at the bottom left portion of the screen. The same goes with turning off and on your camera. Committee staff can mute and unmute you. We'll assist when we move to voting. For all those who call into Zoom, you must hit *6 to unmute. Okay, I'm going to repeat that again. If you are calling into Zoom, you must hit *6. If we do not hear a response in short order, we will move on to our next testimony. Hopefully you already have tested your camera and microphone. Recognizing someone to speak will involve the raise your hand function. For those of you participating in the right column on the bottom of your screen, you'll be able to click on participants, and a tool opens up on the right side of the screen that shows who is in the meeting. And at the bottom, participants of the participants list, there should be a button labeled raise your hand. Click on that if you wish to be recognized. And don't lower your hand. So committee staff will do that for you, so we assure everyone who wants to speak is recognized. Do not use the reaction, thumbs up or clapping, as they disappear on their own and they're difficult to track. Just use the hands up. If you are on the phone, please email directly Rachel, R-A-C-H-E-L dot Ganani, G-A-N-A-N-I at house.mn if you wish to speak, or to Jenna Mouse, J-E-N-N-A dot M-A-U-S at house.mn. Thank you very much to members of the public for being patient with us. We will be taking breaks periodically to make sure you do not miss anything or anyone. I've been notified that a quorum is present. The clerk will call the roll to verify attendance.
Fairless.
Present.
Representative Moeller.
Here.
Representative Scott.
Here.
Representative Albright. Representative Albright. Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Cantrell.
Here.
Representative Carlson. Representative Carlson. Representative Considine.
Here.
Representative Hassan.
Here.
Representative Herr.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Liebling. Representative Liebling.
Here.
Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Mariani.
Here.
Representative Noor.
Here.
Representative O'Neill.
Present.
Representative Robbins. Representative Robbins.
I'm here.
And Representative Zhang. Representative Zhang.
Okay, if others join later on, if I can be given just a heads up by the CA in the same notes area we discussed, to let me know if other folks have joined, and I'll make sure that you're recognized for the official record. Members, today we'll be hearing three bills. The first two are mine, House File 1197 and 1196, a vehicle bill for a DE amendment to suspend statutory deadlines in district and appellate courts during the peacetime emergency, and a vehicle bill for a DE amendment for the harmless error provision for wills that is effective during the peacetime emergency. And then Representative Mahler's House File 798, the vehicle bill for a DE amendment for delay of COLA increase on child support during this peacetime emergency. There will be a fourth bill we'll be discussing as well, too. So the first, we'll be voting eight times audibly in this online hearing, members, so keep that in mind. We did the roll call. We're going to be taking up each one of these. But the first one we're going to be doing is the approval of the minutes. So Vice Chair Mahler has reviewed the minutes and makes a motion to approve the minutes for March 12th, 2020. Is that accurate, Representative Mahler?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
The minutes have been moved. Any discussion? Seeing none, then the committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Chair Lesh.
Aye.
Representative Mahler.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Albright. Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Cantrell.
Aye.
Representative Carlson. Representative Considine.
Aye.
Representative Hassan.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling. Representative Lucero.
Aye.
Representative Mariani.
Aye.
Representative Noor.
Aye.
Representative O'Neill.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
On a vote of 15 ayes and three abs, well, that doesn't matter. On a vote of 15 ayes and zero nays, the motion passes. The first item will be, and the minutes of March 12th, 2020 are approved. The first bill we'll be taking up will be House File 1197. That is my bill. Serving as a vehicle bill for the DE amendment to suspend statutory deadlines in district and appellate courts during the peacetime emergency. So I'll move that House File 1197 be recommended to be placed on the general register. That is the motion before us. Now that we have the bill before us, as I've mentioned, I have a DE1 author's amendment. It is labeled DE1. I'm moving this to put the bill in the shape I desire. Does anyone have any preliminary questions about this DE1 amendment? I don't see any. By the way, so folks know there's a little bit of delay in all the different kinds of communication we're doing here right now, since we don't have line of sight on everyone. And if someone raises a hand or something, I miss it, I will be informed of that, and I will immediately get back to you on it, even if we're taking up. We'll hit the rewind a little bit to make sure that everyone's questions are addressed. I also want to note for the record that Representative Zhang Jie is here with us online now. So the motion is to adopt the DE1 amendment and to get the bill in the shape I desire. On the motion to approve the DE1 amendment, the committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Chair Lesh.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Albright. Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Cantrell.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye, and I apologize. I've been listening and just unmuted myself, so I've been present.
Representative Considine.
Aye.
Representative Hassan.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
Aye.
Representative Mariani.
Aye.
Representative Noor.
Aye.
Representative O'Neill.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
On a vote of 15 ayes and 0 nays, the motion is adopted and the bill is amended. Members, this is a bill we've been working on for a while, and it came through as a request originally from the judicial branch, if you may recall. Chair Scott and I have engaged at length with our Senate colleagues and some interested stakeholders and have reached consensus language that essentially suspends statutory deadlines, including time periods prescribed by statute and statute of limitations during this peacetime emergency that was declared by the governor in Executive Order 2001 and for 60 days thereafter. However, there is a sunset provision of February 15th, 2021. Now remember, the court still has the ability to hold a hearing, require an appearance, or issue an order if the judge terminates that individual circumstances or relevant to public safety, personal safety, or other emergency matters if they require action in a specific case. So we have testifiers in the support of the bill. The first one we have up is Joel Carlson, representing the Minnesota Association for Justice. Representative Carlson, Mr. Carlson, please state your name and title for the record and go ahead and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Joel Carlson, I own a legal research business and government affairs in downtown St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. And we appreciate your committee recognizing the problem that Minnesotans face when they have reduced access to the courts and their justice partners. And we've received many concerns from people across the state about the filing deadlines, and we appreciate the DE1 amendment, which will alleviate, I believe, those concerns. I also appreciate the fact that you have added a 60-day window after the peacetime emergency is over so that we don't have an automatic cliff. We don't think that was available in an executive order, and so we appreciate that provision in the bill as well. The courts have also been addressing their filing and deadline requirements that are set by court rule. They've been issuing best practices as their courthouses have physical distancing, and we appreciate the work that they've done to let everyone in the judicial system and their partners know what's going on. This is a very difficult situation, and it's nice to see all of you for a change. We appreciate everything you're doing. We support the bill as drafted, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carlson. Are there questions from the committee? I don't see any. There's a question from Chair Mariani. Go ahead, Chair Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not being an attorney and knowing that the public is also watching here, I'm wondering if Mr. Carlson can give us just a couple examples of what this means in the real world. I can imagine it applies to a myriad of instances, but just if you can give us a couple examples of what this would translate into terms of cases that are out there.
Go ahead, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mariani, I'll try and answer that. I don't know how to Zoom a friend yet, but I think I can answer it. There are all kinds of different statutory limitation periods on a variety of cases, whether it's an employment law case, a personal injury case, a contract case, and some of those may be approaching the time to be filed in court. What this bill will do will toll that period of time so that when the peacetime emergency is over, you won't have lost that potentially 4 or 5 months of time to bring your case to court. And many instances require preparatory work before you can put a case in suit. And so we don't have access to experts during this time. And this just gives everyone time to make sure their legal rights are protected and that they can have access to the court. They haven't lost anything during this time. And that's what this legislation does.
Thank you. Any other questions that are up from members? I don't see any other hands up, but if that does occur, we can address those with Mr. Carlson later on. Our next testifier we have is Samuel Spade, housing attorney with Homeline. Mr. Spade, please state your name and title for the record and begin your testimony.
Chair Lesh, members of the committee, my name is Samuel Spade. I'm an attorney at Homeline, and Homeline's a research director. Homeline is a nonprofit whose primary program is a statewide hotline, which currently averages about 1,000 clients each month. And we are hearing from many renters throughout the state with concerns about maintaining their housing stability and safety during this pandemic. We fully support this bill, because among many other important issues, we believe it would allow the courts to place a pause on eviction cases. The initial hearing in an eviction case has to happen within 7 to 14 days statutorily. Otherwise, and this would allow the courts to pause that or delay that. And this ability to delay the initial hearings is important. There are already hundreds of cases prior to the governor's executive order suspending evictions. We are concerned that there will be a flood of non-payment eviction cases that occur as soon as this order is lifted. We're taking calls every day from tenants who cannot afford to pay rent due to a loss of income resulting from COVID-19. This bill will give courts the freedom to solve the problems of overwhelming eviction filings. However, we do want to highlight that it does not require the courts to do so, and that additional action should be taken either by the courts or by the legislature to handle the amount of eviction cases that will be filed when the emergency order lifts. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today and share the concerns of the tenants that we represent, and we appreciate your support of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Spade, for your testimony. We were getting quite a bit of feedback or echo on that. I don't know if anyone else heard that at the same time or it was just on my end, but if you can, I don't know, we're going to have to figure out something else about the background noise on that. So I don't see any other questions or any other hands raised. But we will now be moving to committee discussion. Is there any other committee discussion on House File 1197 as amended? Although I would note, I want to correct the record. there were 17 ayes on the DE1 amendment for 1197, not 15 ayes. I do see that Chair Mariani has a question. Go ahead, Chair Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be to you, but it could be to either one of our testifiers. I'm wondering, I'm just trying to get an understanding of the scope, and Mr. Carlson's testimony was very helpful. But would this apply, for instance, for traffic violations and statutory deadlines related to responding and adjudicating those?
Well, Chair Mariani, I guess what I'd like to do, because your question could pose a couple different scenarios depending on what you mean by traffic violations. You're wondering if traffic charges on petties would get delayed? Well, why don't we just move to Mr. Johnson? Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, members, this is Ben Johnson with House Research. Any statutory deadlines would be affected by this? Any deadlines that are, and that's statutory deadlines for the proceedings in the district courts. Any other deadlines either set in court rules or that don't actually involve proceedings in the district courts would not apply. The requirement, for example, to pay a traffic ticket within a period of time would not be a statutory deadline that governs the proceedings in the district court.
That's helpful. So if you request a court date to contest your speeding ticket, it would be implicated. But if you do not contest the ticket or request a court date, then in fact, it doesn't apply. Is that correct, Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair and members, I would say that is correct. So once you request that court date, any statutory deadline, and frankly, without looking it up, I'm not sure if those deadlines are in statute or in rules, but if those deadlines are in statute, then they would not be enforced.
Okay, excellent, thank you. I don't see any other hands raised. Are folks getting an echo from me now?
Yes, okay. I hear an echo.
I don't know if there's much you can do about that. I don't see any other concerns, so we're prepared to vote on House File 11. Representative Noor.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to ask the Minnesota House Info to reduce their volume or mute. We're getting the echoes when the Minnesota House Info picks up the information.
Okay. Well, I'm not a sound guy, so if that helps, I'll reduce mine as well, too. So the motion before us is that House File 1197, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Chair Lesh.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Albright. Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Cantrell.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Considine.
Aye.
Representative Hassan.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Mariani.
Aye.
Representative Noor.
Aye.
Representative O'Neill.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
So there being 17 ayes and zero nays, the motion is passed. House File 1197 is placed on the General Register. Thank you, members. And zero nays. I think I already said that. The next bill we have up is House File 1196. This is a vehicle bill for my DE amendment, which allows for the harmless error provision for wills and writings to be effective during the peacetime emergency. I'll move that House File 1196 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Now that's before us, I move my DE1 amendment. This amendment puts the bill in the shape that I desire. Does anyone have any preliminary questions about the DE1 amendment? I don't see any hands up. Then we will proceed and move to a vote on the DE1 amendment. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Chair Lesh.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Albright. Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Cantrell.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Considine.
Aye.
Representative Hassan.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Mariani.
Aye.
Representative Noor.
Aye.
Representative O'Neill.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
There being 17 ayes and zero nays, the motion is passed and the DE1 amendment is adopted. Members, looking at the bill as amended, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, many Minnesotans, especially those at high risk, are seeking to create estate plans, but the social distancing requirements have made it more difficult to properly execute a will, especially in light of the fact that many of us are concerned about our elderly folks who are maybe in assisted living facilities. So this proposal adopts a uniform probate code provision that allows non-conforming wills to be probated if the execution defects are shown by clear and convincing evidence to be harmless errors. So there are several other states that have done this: Colorado, Hawaii, Michigan, Montana, South Dakota, and Utah. This is a temporary provision effective for wills and writings executed on or after March 13th, when the peacetime emergency was declared, but before February 15th of next year. So documents drafted during this time will always be able to rely on this provision, even if the testator dies years later after all this is over. Minnesota State Bar Association supports this provision, and in fact, they want it to be permanent change to allow for harmless errors when drafting wills, but we're not going to do that right now. The testifiers in support of the bill for the Minnesota State Bar Association, we have with us Brian Lake on behalf of the Minnesota State Bar Association. Mr. Lake, please state your name and title for the record. Go ahead and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian Lake, I'm a solo practice attorney in Minneapolis. I am representing the Minnesota State Bar Association. For those who might be unaware, the bar is a voluntary professional association with about 15,000 members statewide in Minnesota. And I think Chair Lesh did a good job of giving an overview of what the bill is about, obviously dealing with will execution requirements and challenges that we're facing now. So I think I'm just going to give you real quick three things, a little background on what our witnessing execution standards are, some of the problems that we're seeing related to the COVID pandemic, and then a little bit about the solution we're proposing today. So there's three primary requirements in Minnesota law to have a valid will. It has to be in writing. It can be any kind of writing. It can be handwritten, could be made on a do-it-yourself computer software, could be typed on a typewriter, could be drafted by an attorney. They're all fine as long as it's in writing. Second, it needs to be signed by the testator. So the testator is the person for whom the will is drafted. They need to sign, but there's also a little bit of flexibility there where they could appoint someone else or direct someone else to sign on their behalf. And then finally, it needs to be signed by two witnesses. And again, there's a little bit of flexibility built in there where the witnesses don't necessarily have to be present at the same time. They don't necessarily have to see the testator sign the will. It is enough if they witness the testator acknowledging that they signed the will. And then there's an extensive amount of case law dealing with the witnessing standards and how that should be interpreted. But what we're seeing right now with the COVID pandemic is obviously a little more challenging to get wills properly executed. Clearly, a lot of people don't want to leave their homes, especially people in at-risk populations. You know, Chair Lesh mentioned the elderly folks not necessarily wanting to go to their lawyer's office and be in close quarters in a conference room with a bunch of people and their attorney, two witnesses, maybe a notary, maybe a legal secretary running in and out making copies, perhaps some family members are there. So folks are just afraid to do that. And then, of course, we've got people who are quarantined or on lockdown and, say, an assisted living facility, and they simply can't do those kind of things even if they want to. So I guess how this is being dealt with, you can kind of put it in three different buckets. And the first bucket would be attorneys are being a little more creative in how they're executing wills and the way that they're guiding their clients to make sure that's done properly. And that's not really a concern. And I think attorneys have the knowledge of the statute and certainly the relevant case law to make sure that this can be done properly, done in a valid way, and make sure that clients are still kept safe and healthy. The problems arise in a couple other scenarios. One is where clients are saying to their attorneys, hey, I don't want to come in. Can you just mail me the documents? I'm going to take care of the execution myself. In any kind of circumstance, even outside of this pandemic, it always makes attorneys nervous because although it sounds simple, clients frequently make technical errors when they're executing these documents. They might sign on the wrong line, or you know, an attorney shared with me a recent story about he mailed the documents to the client, and the attorney had put those little helpful stickers on there, the sign here, arrowed stickers. Well, the client signed on top of the stickers, so they had to end up redoing everything. So these kind of things happen. They're probably going to happen more frequently now with more people trying to do the stuff themselves. And then you have the folks who are operating on their own with the, you know, do-it-yourself software, do-it-yourself website, handling all the execution on their own with no attorney oversight. So there the concern is, you know, folks may not necessarily be aware of the statutory nuances, almost certainly aren't aware of the case law interpreting the witnessing standards. And we've heard anecdotal stories about folks doing some, you know, unconventional witnessing methods, you know, perhaps using video conferencing or some other things that our courts just have not considered yet. So the concern is that there's been, you know, some wills out there that are being executed improperly. If they're improperly executed, they're going to be found invalid. And if they're invalid, then the testator's wishes aren't going to be followed, no matter how clear and obvious they are. So this is really a nationwide problem. Folks are dealing with this all over the country, and states have dealt with it differently. There's been, in some states, governors have issued executive orders just doing away with witnessing requirements entirely during the pandemic. We think that is a step too far and might actually create more problems than it solves. You know, there's this tension where you want to make execution easier, but the more you relax the standards, you actually increase the chances for fraud or undue influence. And that's where having witnesses is really important because they can be in the room, they can get a read for whether the person really understands what they're doing or whether they're disoriented or whether there's someone in the room perhaps, you know, pushing the person to do something that maybe the person doesn't necessarily want to do or isn't necessarily good for them. So so what we have tried to do is bring forward a proposal that will address the concerns that are arising now, but do it in a way that preserves the integrity of our will execution standards. So we're not proposing to change any of our big three of in writing, signed by the testator, signed by two witnesses. What we are proposing, however, though, is to adopt a provision from the Uniform Probate Code, harmless error rule that would allow for imperfectly executed wills to go ahead and be probated if the court finds that the execution defects were shown by clear and convincing evidence to be harmless errors. So the clear and convincing standard is really important. I want to note that for you, that is the highest evidentiary standard in a civil case. So it kind of protects both ways. If the testator's intent is clear and obvious, it protects that, but it also protects against a bad actor bringing forward, you know, a false document. So as Chair Lesh mentioned, this exact language has been adopted in 7 other states. In addition, we're aware of at least 2 other states that have adopted kind of a modified version of the harmless error rule. So this is becoming more and more common. And just to give the committee a couple real quick stories about how this has been interpreted in other states, I think in general, it's very, very tough to overcome the clear and convincing standard if the testator did not sign at all or if there were no witnesses. However, the harmless error rule has been applied in situations like where one witness signed before the testator signed and the other witness signed in a different room and wasn't quite clear if they saw the testator sign, situations like that. On the flip side of that, there was a case, I think, out of South Dakota where a married woman died and she did not have a will. And there was some evidence showing that her and her husband were fine not having a will, and they were fine with South Dakota's statute that just said if you die without a will, everything goes to your spouse. However, after this woman died, her sister brought forward an alleged codicil to the will. So a codicil is an amendment to the will. And this alleged codicil just said, basically, everything goes to my sister. In other words, everything went to the woman who was presenting this alleged codicil. She also happened to be the only witness for this codicil. And then she also presented another document that was not signed by anybody and not witnessed by anybody. And the court in that case found that she was just not a convincing witness and did not meet the clear and convincing standard. So that's just a little bit of real-life impact of how this works. But we believe the harmless error rule would be a really balanced approach that would allow courts to salvage imperfectly executed documents so they don't fail based on some technicality, as long as the testator's intent was clear and convincing. So it will serve justice by allowing the testator's clear intent to be implemented. At the same time, it's balanced enough to preserve the integrity of our current system and guard against fraud and undue influence. And as Chair Lesh mentioned, we don't view this as just a stopgap solution. We wanted to bring you something that we really think would be a good permanent addition to Minnesota law. We totally understand, though, why the sunset's being put in place now, given current circumstances. But with that, I just want to also thank Chair Lesh, Representative Scott, and all the other folks who worked really hard on the proposal to make sure that it was in shape and ready to go today. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lake, for that testimony. I see one hand up from Representative Robbins. Go ahead, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Lake. I just wanted to clarify, is under these changes the testator signature not required?
No, it's we're not changing the standards at all. So none of the statutory standards are going to change. It's really just how they're interpreted. So the harmless error rule basically says if there's not a perfect compliance, the court can overlook it as long as the testator's intent was really clear. But in other states that have this, I'm only aware of one case that was in New Jersey, which has a very, very different litigation climate, much more aggressive there, where they allowed a will to be probated even though the testator didn't sign it. And none of the other states that have this have allowed a will to be probated if the testator did not sign.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, may I ask another?
Yes, go ahead, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to be clear, if someone under these more flexible rules would be in quarantine in an assisted living facility, perhaps, and they do not sign the actual paperwork, that would still be given flexibility by the court in this instance?
The court would still have flexibility. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Representative Robbins, the court would have some flexibility in any circumstance under this rule. I can tell you that, you know, in the situations you describe where, like, someone's on quarantine or they're on lockdown in a facility, attorneys are figuring out ways to get around that. You know, you can do things like the other day I was talking to my old neighbor. She's 90 years old. She's in lockdown in a facility. The way that she visits her kids and grandkids is they come and they stand outside the glass front door and they wave at each other and they talk on cell phones. But then you're in the line of sight. So you can do witnessing that way. And as I mentioned, our statute allows the testator to direct someone else, to ask someone else to sign on their behalf. So there's some flexibility built into the current statute that allows folks to get around some of those requirements. You know, another story, an attorney was recently working with a client who was quarantined. They needed two witnesses, so they had the client's wife sign as a witness, which isn't the best practice to have a relative sign, but it is okay. And then they used their mail carrier, again, doing the glass door witnessing thing. So there are workarounds that the folks are using to make this stuff happen in a way that complies with statutory standards.
Thank you, Mr. Licken. Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you've alluded on several occasions to the flexibility built into the current standard. So why isn't that sufficient? Why is this necessary?
Mr. Lake?
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins. It's necessary because we're hearing anecdotally that folks are using some unconventional witnessing methods that have not been evaluated by our court. So I mentioned there's an extensive amount of case law dealing with witnessing standards, but they haven't addressed things like video conferencing. So you could have some folks, maybe they're doing the, you know, do-it-yourself software, they're doing their own executions. Maybe they think it's okay to just FaceTime a couple people and have them witness that way. And that's just, those are instances that our courts have not examined yet. So if nothing changes, if this proposal is not introduced and a court gets one of those cases where there's FaceTime witnessing and they decide, you know, that doesn't meet statutory compliance, that will be invalidated. However, it could possibly be saved if the harmless error rule is implemented via this bill. In that case, even if the court decided, you know, this is doesn't really comply with statutory standards, they might say, however, the testator's intent here was clear and obvious, and, you know, the witnessing methodology is just a harmless error, and we're going to go ahead and probate the bill. So it just, it opens the door a little bit wider and gives the court a little more flexibility to deal with the individual circumstances and the individual evidence in a specific case.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say for the record that I have some concerns about this, especially if that testator signature is no longer required specifically, which I've understood from research memos that that is the case in this. So I'm supportive of what you're trying to do, I think, but I still have many concerns. Thank you.
Understood. Thank you and for putting this on the record.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Robbins. Mr. Lake?
Just a quick response to that. I want to be clear again that we are not removing the requirement from statute that the testator sign. And again, and only one other state that has the harmless error rule, am I aware of a court that allowed an unsigned will to go forward, and all the other ones they have not applied the harmless error rule when the testator did not sign. It's really tough to get over the clear and convincing evidentiary standard when there's no testator signature.
Understood. Thank you, Mr. Lake. I don't see any other hands up, nor do I see any anyone else noticed as wanting to speak to this. And so our next move will be to vote on House File 1196 as amended. So the committee legislative assistant will take the role. The motion before us is that House File 1196 as amended be recommended to be placed on the general register. Go ahead, Committee CLA.
Chair Lesh.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Albright. Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Cantrell.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Considine.
Aye.
Representative Hassan.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
Aye.
Representative Mariani.
Aye.
Representative Noor.
Aye.
Representative O'Neill.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye, because there's a sunset. I'll be watching it carefully. Thank you.
And Representative Zhang.
Aye.
On a vote of 17 ayes and zero nays, the motion passes, and House File 1196, as amended, is placed on the General Register. The next bill we'll be taking up is House File 798, Representative Mahler. We are right on time, by the way. This was set to start at 10:36, and it is now 10:37. So nice job, committee staff, okay? And a nice job on everyone not talking too long, too. So House File 798 is a vehicle bill for a DE amendment to extend the opportunity for child support obligors, that means the people paying, to contest a cost of living increase during the peacetime emergency. Representative Mahler moves that House File 798 be placed on the General Register. And you have a DE1 author amendment. Is that correct, Representative Mahler?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, would you like a motion to put the to move the DE1 amendment to put in the bill in the form you so desire?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
So Representative Mahler offers the House File 798 DE1. Does everyone, assuming everyone has the amendment, the bill puts the shape and the author desires. Does anyone have any preliminary questions about the DE1? I don't see any hands up, nor do I see any notifications from my messaging. So then we will move to vote on the DE1. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Chair Lesh.
Aye.
Representative Mahler.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Albright. Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Cantrell.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Considine.
Aye.
Representative Hassan.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Chero.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Mariani.
Yes.
Representative Noor.
Yes.
Representative O'Neill.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
On a vote of 17 ayes and zero nays, the DE1 amendment is adopted and House File 798 is amended. So we have Representative Mahler, you have some testifiers, or did you want to make any statements before we move to testifiers, Representative Mahler?
If I can, Mr. Chair, just really briefly, and then I can introduce my testifier.
Sure.
Thank you. So Mr. Chair and members, this right now under statute, there is a cost of living adjustment that's set to go into effect here at about almost 5% for people paying child support, which obviously in the times that we're in right now, that's going to be very difficult for a lot of people to pay. And so what this bill does now with the DE amendment is allow some more time for folks to contest that automatic increase. And before I introduce my testifier, I just would really like to thank Chair Scott and to the staff who worked on this very quickly to get broad bipartisan support and also a number of stakeholders to weigh in and make sure that there were any concerns were addressed and that this was vetted. So I just wanted to thank them. And with that, Mr. Chair, I believe Melissa Rossow is here and ready to testify.
Excellent. Thank you, Representative Mahler. Ms. Rossow, please state your name and title for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Melissa Rossow. I am an assistant Ramsey County attorney. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mahler for allowing me to testify on this bill today. I am also the director of the Human Services Legal Division for the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, which includes child protection, civil commitments, and child support. The purpose of this amendment to the bill is to extend the time for parties to contest the cost of living adjustment. All child support orders have a provision in it that states that there will be a biennial cost of living adjustment, meaning every other year the child support amount will be looked at and adjusted through a process found in Minnesota Statutes 518A.75. The adjustment is based on the Consumer Price Index, basically reflecting inflation. And it this year's percentage of adjustment is 4.7% because it's based on the past 2 years of the CPI when the economy was doing very well. A short summary of the COLA process, or COLA as we call it, is that the Department of Human Services mails out notices to approximately half of the child support 4D caseload. Uh-oh. I just want to state that these are the cases that we're talking about. These are child support 4D cases, not cases that are outside of that system. The department sends out the notices. They're required to do so at least 20 days prior to the effective date of the COLA, which is May 1st. The notices were mailed out last week by the Department of Human Services, and this year there were approximately 45,000 notices mailed out. Last year there was approximately 46,000 notices mailed out, so you can see it's half of the caseload every other year. Parties have the right to file a motion to contest the cost of living adjustment if they don't agree with it. That motion, according to the statute, must be filed and served by April 30th, which is right around the corner. That is the day before the adjustment takes place, which is May 1st each year. Motions are heard in the expedited process before child support magistrates. And when there is a motion to contest, the child support magistrate needs to consider whether the obligor has established an insufficient cost of living or other increase in income. And the magistrate can deny the cost of living adjustment, meaning that they can say there will be no cost of living adjustment. They can grant a partial cost of living adjustment, say half of what the percentage was, or they can say that the whole adjustment should take place. As you probably can imagine, parties are going to have unique challenges to contest the cost of living adjustment this year by April 30th. April 30th is right in the heart of all of the access issues, access to the courts, the courthouses being physically closed, self-help centers physically being closed, county offices where parties seek support, and even public libraries where parties can go and use computers and have Wi-Fi to assist them are closed at this time. Governor Walz's stay-at-home order also is presenting some problems for people. And like I said, the time frame to contest this is right in the middle of all of what's going on. And this is concerning enough, but adding a proposed adjustment of 4.7% right now, as people are continuing to lose their jobs, have reduced hours, needing to stay home with children, maybe being ill or taking care of ill relatives, that deadline to contest having an extension is really important. The bill before you has two different extensions to allow the motion to contest the cost of living adjustment. The first extension is June 30th, 2020. That's available for anybody without needing to prove that they had a reason to delay serving and file their motion. The second extension is October 31st, 2020, and is available for those who can show the court that for a reason related to COVID-19 pandemic, they were unable to timely serve and file the cost of living adjustments motion to contest. Child support obligees, those receiving child support, will still have the right to appear and state their opinion to the court. And if not contested, so a motion is not filed even by October 31st, the cost of living adjustment will be effective May 1st under this bill. If it is contested and the court finds that the cost of living adjustment was appropriate in whole or in part, the effective date will be May 1st, or the court can decide another date that it deems appropriate. And if the COLA cost of living adjustment goes into effect on May 1st and is later contested, which probably will happen, the Minnesota statute 518A.52 describes the methodology in which the obligor can be made whole. Essentially, if there are child support arrears on the case, those arrears will be reduced. And if there are no arrears or no arrears remaining after the reduction, then the ongoing child support obligation will be reduced by a monthly amount of no more than 20% each month until the child support obligor is made whole. I'm pleased to let you know that the county attorney's offices and child support offices for Anoka, Dakota, Hennepin, and Ramsey counties are all on board and support this bill and find the importance as much as my own county office does. As well as the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, the Minnesota State Bar Association Family Law Section through its governing council, and the Legal Services Advocacy Project also support this bill. It's quite a good group of people with diverse perspectives that have taken a look at this issue and have seen the importance of allowing some more time during this pandemic. I also want to thank Representative Scott and Representative Lesh, Representative Mueller, and everybody else who was involved in getting this through very quickly. As you can tell, our office feels that this is very important for folks that we serve at this time. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Russo. Any questions? I don't see any hands up. Oh, wait, yes, I did. Now I missed them, so stand by for a second here. Chair Liebling had a question. Go ahead, Chair Liebling.
So thank you very much. So earlier we considered another bill, House File 1197, that give some flexibility on court deadlines generally. And I'm just wondering if there's any interaction between this bill and the one that we considered previously.
Ms. Russo?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, and members. Basically, when we took a look at 1197, since the expedited child support process was not mentioned in that bill, we made the assumption that this 1197 didn't apply to these child support hearings. It's specific to district court. The expedited process has a separate set of court rules that are written for self-representative litigants, particularly to make getting into court and handling their child support matters more efficient, easier, and timely for them. And so we felt that this standalone bill was necessary because of that. Additionally, since the child support expedited process is designed for that efficiency and for ease of self-represented litigants, we felt that having something specific to the cost of living adjustment with this very tight turnaround would be necessary this year. We did consider asking whether it would be a good idea to just add the expedited process to Chair Lesh's bill, but we felt that that might lead to more confusion for the self-representative litigants who are the primary users of the expedited process rules and the statute relating to COLA.
Did you, can we have Ms. Mullen or Mr. Johnson, did you want to take a crack at this as well in terms of your perspective? Well, that could answer your question as well, too.
Mr. Chair, this is...
Well, Mr. Johnson, go ahead.
This is Ben Johnson. Our colleague, Sarah Sunderman, drafted this language. I'm actually in the middle of an email exchange with her right now asking how they saw this interacting with that first provision. Like Representative Liebling, I think there may be some overlap here. The initial bill did say that any deadlines imposed by statute related to proceedings in the district courts are suspended. This provision relates to when notice should go out, that we're talking about relates to when notice should go out and when those COLAs take effect, and also when a challenge must be filed. I think we're trying to figure out whether that is a deadline imposed by statute.
Chair and members, this is Mary. I think if there is a concern, one of the things we could do is when the reviser puts these together, we're sort of operating under the assumption that these will likely be in the same bill. And in that case, we could have a clarification that says something along the lines of notwithstanding what is now House File 1197, but which may be incorporated into a larger bill. We could include something like that to make sure that these two bills are not operating in conflict, if that would be helpful.
Chair Liebling? Yeah, that would help. Chair Liebling?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I agree. I think I just want to make sure there isn't any unintended effect here. So that sounds to me like a good solution, not having looked at it more closely, but I just want us to be sure that we're paying attention to that.
Good. We'll wait on that. The next one we have on the list is Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chen, members. My question is, the notices have been sent already. Are we planning to send a new notices informing of the changes to the impacted parties? And the second question that I have is the notices of motion and motion to stop caller that will likely increase because the obligors have already received the notices of caller. How will that really be handled from the back end from the county perspective?
Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Noor. I can't speak for the Department of Human Services. I have been in some conversations with people in the Child Support Division, and it certainly has been discussed sending out an additional notice. I can speak from my own county perspective that last week we sent out a postcard to this group of individuals, letting them know that we're here to answer questions for them about child support modifications and the cost of living adjustment. And on behalf of my county, we will be reaching out to these affected people. It's just under 4,500 people here in Ramsey County that received obligors who received these notices. So we are going to take a proactive step, but I can't speak on behalf of the departments for sure on what their plans are.
I'm sorry, Representative Noor?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make sure that the Department of Human Services takes a proactive measures to address this issue if necessary. So thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Representative Noor. Next one we have on the list is Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has to do with, since we're not moving the May 1st date, and COLA will go into effect, then I'm assuming there'll be a whole lot of people, just as Representative Noor just said, that will be waiting until June 30th to see if they're actually able to comply with that. So is there any abatement from fines or fees or penalties of any type? I'm just not familiar with this part of law because they've waited now till June 30th.
Ms. Rosso, was that a question for Ms. Rosso, Representative O'Neill?
Whoever knows that part of law to know what, if there's fines or fees or penalties or something that go along with not complying with the May 1st
Okay.
Normally, you know, the day before that, you would file with the court, so you would know that there's something contested. But we've got a gap now, so you can contest it really all the way till October 31st. And in the time between May 1st and October 31st, is there going to be a buildup of fines or fees? I understand that she said in the rears would get taken care of, but is there any other penalty that would be assessed that we haven't thought of?
Sure, Ms. Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill. As you identified, the overpayment statute will take care of making the obligor whole if the contest happens after the cost of living adjustment takes place. Just to explain a little background of why we chose to look at it this way is the notices were going to need to get sent out, and it does take quite a lot of time and resources for the Department of Human Services to change things in their computer system known as PRISM. And so this bill was specifically written to allow for actions to take place without having to reprogram PRISM. We feared that if there was going to be reprogramming time and expense, that we wouldn't be having this opportunity to allow an extension for the time to contest. So that's just a little background relating to that. The other thing is there are enforcement remedies that are used by counties when there are child support arrears. So when someone isn't paying their arrears. Right now, the National Child Support Enforcement Association, along with the federal child support program, and here in Minnesota, we're looking at how to operate differently because of this global pandemic and because of the incredible loss of jobs that people are having. What would happen if somebody did not contest until, say, June 29th, is that the cost of living adjustment will go into effect on May 1st. The contest happens on June 29th, and let's say the hearing is held in September. We will be noting on the system that that contest happened, and we will be working to ensure that we are treating both the obligor and the obligee fairly. We have the opportunity to know who is paying and not paying through our automated system. And so what would be occurring now is that if someone had a child support obligation and this 4.7% was added to it, those enforcement remedies may take place, but we would take a look to see if that was appropriate during this time. I know that was a lot of words to explain that. I'm open to additional questions.
Does that answer your question, Representative O'Neill?
No. I don't. So I guess it does, but it so this bill doesn't address any of the penalties, even though they're exercising what we're giving them as their right to do. So we haven't addressed the penalties for not paying the COLA, and I think that might be problematic. If we're going to do this, I think that we should also waive the penalties for not paying the COLA. If we're saying you've got, you know, all the way till October 31st to say you can actually contest it, that's a buildup over time of whatever remedy. She didn't specifically say what the remedy was, but I'm assuming that's some sort of fine or penalty of some sort that's maybe a percentage of the whole or something. But if we haven't addressed that, then that just seems a little unfair. We should maybe spell that out more clearly in this language.
Well, what I'd like to do is, since we arrived at kind of consensus language on this, I'd like to have that question explored by Mr. Johnson, Ms. Mullen, and maybe in concert with Ms. Russo, and get an answer back to you, Representative O'Neill. And to the extent that you decide and others decide that there should be ameliorative language to get together on a decision on that in conjunction with Chair Scott and some others, if that's okay with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that if we're going to extend deadlines, we shouldn't penalize people because we've extended deadlines. And I think that should be taken into account. And I realize that each county agency can decide, but I think it should come from us if we've already given them an extension. So I appreciate the taking a better, you know, a closer look at that as well.
Understood. Thank you. The next one, last one I have on the list is Representative Mahler. Did you want to address a question, Representative Mahler, or was this kind of like your closing statement?
So, Mr. Chair, I can do a combination here if that's okay. So to address Chair Liebling's question initially, that was something that we did consider when we got the draft language and talked about this with Ms. Rosso and the other body. And I'll just note as well that the windows, the timelines are different between Chair Lesh's court's bill and what we're doing here, which I think is another reason why this is necessary to do separately. And I'm happy to provide the exchange that we had back and forth about this issue also with House Research, so they're kind of aware of what our thought process was on that. In addition, I would also note that I've heard from Mr. Carlson, and neither Violence Free Minnesota nor the Minnesota Association for Justice had any concerns with this language, and in fact agreed with Ms. Rosso's testimony about why this was necessary in light of the other court's bill that we already passed this morning. So, but I am, these were really excellent questions, and I'm glad we have the opportunity to hear your questions and your concerns, members, and sounds like we'll be doing some follow-up on some of those issues. So I appreciate that, and I hope that you will support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mahler. Seeing that no other questions or comments from committee members, we're prepared to move to a vote on House File 798 as amended. Motion before us from Representative Mahler is that House File 798 as amended be recommended to be placed on the general register. The committee's legislative assistant will take the roll.
Chair Lesh.
Aye.
Representative Mahler.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Albright. Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Cantrell.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Considine. Representative Considine.
Aye.
Representative Hassan.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye. We're almost there, Emily. Hold on.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Mariani.
Aye.
Representative Noor.
Aye.
Representative O'Neill.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
On a vote of 17 ayes and zero nays, the motion passes, and House File 798, as amended, is placed on the general register. Thank you, members. The next bill we're going to be moving to, members, this is the final provision we're going to discuss today. It's 7486, Public Health Emergency Marriage License Application and Oath Without Appearance. The language was worked on and finally agreed to just yesterday morning, right around 9 a.m., so we posted the language so we can discuss it at today's hearing, but we'll not be taking any votes today. So Representative Scott, will you tell us about this provision?
Sure. I was asked to work on this bill with Representative Dabney. I see he's online now. And Mr. Chair, this bill addresses the requirement in statute that when a couple applies for a marriage license, that at least one of them appear in person to be vetted or have their sworn in under oath. And so, of course, that's not a practical thing to do these days because there's no one at the courthouse to help make that happen. So this bill addresses that and allows just during this time of the pandemic to have them either email, snail mail, or fax their application, and then via either audio or video have the county official or city official. Oh, we're getting an echo. Sorry. I'll turn my volume down. That's super distracting when you're trying to talk. So they would be video or audio. Under oath, they would be examined either by video or audio. That's what I'm trying to say.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Scott. Representative Dabney, you worked on the language and you've joined us as well, too. Do you want to add anything to what Chair Scott just said?
Thank you, Chair Lesh, and thank you to Representative Scott for her efforts over the weekend, and a big shout out to Ms. Ghanani and Ms. Mullen for their persistence over the weekend and into yesterday to get this language resolved with our friends in the Senate. Representative Scott presented it well. It's time limited. It's targeted only for the current peacetime emergency. It's voluntary on registrars, and allows couples that I know I'm being contacted by who wanted to get married, and particularly in response to some of the stress of the pandemic, really want to move forward with receiving both the emotional and legal benefits of marriage. And I think this facilitates that. And I know my constituents who contacted me are very appreciative of the work that has been done bipartisanly and bicamerally to get us to this point. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Dabney. We have with us one testifier, Rebecca Holshue, Senior Assistant Hedman County Attorney, to offer technical advice on how the provision would be implemented. She leads the operations line of the business team in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. So, Ms. Holshue, did you want to make any statements at a time or just stand for questions based upon what was presented by Chair Scott and Chair Dabney?
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd be happy to give a brief overview of the process the county's developed and then answer any questions.
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Becca Holshue. I'm an assistant county attorney appearing today on behalf of the county and our director of licensing. I appreciate your consideration of this language and the opportunity to address the committee. This legislation allows local registrars to provide access to marriage, which is a constitutional right, while conducting the due diligence required to ensure the proposed marriage is legal. This legislation will ensure similar access to marriage licenses across the state during this peacetime emergency. As the committee knows, Section 51708 requires the local registrar to examine the parties upon oath to determine whether or not the marriage is legal. This is an important function that is ordinarily performed at the service counter with both parties to the marriage present. Current law does allow one party to submit a notarized statement in lieu of appearing in person if they're unable to do so. Consistent with this proposed legislation, Hennepin County has developed two options for the remote issuance of marriage licenses during the current pandemic. Under the first option, applicants would complete and submit the marriage license application. Each applicant would also need to complete a written verification to supplement the application. This is a new form the county has developed. It's a list of written questions that's designed to replace the due diligence inquiry that would ordinarily be performed at the service counter. Each applicant must swear or affirm that their statements on the verification are true and correct in front of a notary. Upon receipt of both the application and this verification, the registrar will then issue a license to the couple. The second option also requires the same marriage license application, which the couple would complete and submit. The couple will then contact us to schedule an online video conference with registrar staff. Through that video conference, staff will ask the parties for proof of identification and conduct the due diligence inquiry. We would then issue a license to the couple. There continues to be significant demand for marriage licenses, even in this time of emergency. In fact, our staff are reporting that the demand is increasing. We've received numerous inquiries about how to obtain a marriage license during this time that the service centers are closed. In a comparable time period last year, in March through June of 2019, the county issued nearly 3,000 marriage licenses. The proposed legislation provides access to marriage during this difficult time while allowing registrars to perform their due diligence. I'm happy to answer any questions the chair or the committee may have.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Holshue. Are there any questions or from committee members? We have one so far from Representative O'Neill. Go ahead, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's really kind of for nonpartisan research. I'm wondering if there are other licenses or permits that also require in-person processing that we have. This deals with marriages, but are there other things as well that we may need to deal with as well?
Okay, Ms. Mullen, is your department, right? Or is it Mr. Johnson?
That's me, Chair and members. Representative O'Neill, can you repeat the question?
Go ahead, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there other licenses or permits that require in-person contact, yeah, I guess, with an employee of the county in order to process it besides marriage licenses?
Sure. Chair and members, there are some other provisions that are of real estate law and zoning and permitting at the county level that the counties are looking at. They don't necessarily statutorily require an in-person presence. I think one of the ones that people have talked about are firearm permits. So the counties are working with different groups to try to deal with those. So basically, yes, and people are working on it, but it's not in this bill.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm glad that's being worked on. I haven't heard much about it being worked on. I know that many people have brought to me concerns about not being able to get a permit to carry, because that requires an in-person contact with an employee or the sheriff's department, I suppose. So I just wanted to raise that and make sure that that is still a consideration. And I do actually have an idea for an oral amendment if we want to add that at the end to do a simple repealer of that requirement for permit to carry. It would be, and I'll just offer it for consideration. It would be repealing 624.71. Sir?
I just know we're not actually voting on this today. This is an informational hearing, because the time factor. So if you wanted to make that as a statement, you could, but we're not going to be voting on any amendments, whether it's oral or on this bill at all either.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for consideration then, to repeal the requirement for permit to carry would be 624.714, subdivision 3, paragraph E. I would make that as a consideration for the committee.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other comments or questions from members of the committee about the bill? Oh yeah, Chair Scott, you have a question, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill. I know, I'm pretty sure that the GovOps committee, there's some folks working on some other issues that are similar to this where it kind of requires an in-person contact. Some of them are zoning issues. But there is some movement on this, because obviously, you know, there's a lot of front-facing people at the city and county levels that aren't working right now. So we have to figure out ways to work around that.
Great. Thank you for that, Chair Scott. We are at the end of our committee time. There's no other matters either before the committee. So members will be conducting future remote hearings that will be noticed on our committee page. Until then, this remote hearing of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee is adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.